I never feel powerless because the only thing that could make me powerless is sitting down like, wow, I just got yet another rejection from an investor. If I spend time designating my attention to this, I have lost 5 essential minutes on doing something that is productive.
Welcome to We All Make Mistakes, the podcast that finds value in what everyone else is trying to avoid, getting it wrong, or as Barack Obama once put it, screwing it up. My mission is to challenge what it means to be successful and to show you that people at the top of their game have not always made perfect choices. That's reassuring, right? In today's episode, we'll talk about how you can help the planet while still building a business. We'll talk about the role of data and the role it plays in building climate change software like Plan A and beyond. My guest today on We All Make Mistakes is Lyubomila Jordanova, the entrepreneur behind one of the most influential clean tech startups in Europe. In 2017, she founded Plan A because there is no Planet B. As the CEO of Plan A, Lyubomila helps companies measure, reduce and report on their business carbon footprint thanks to their award-winning science-based software. Beyond her business, Lyubomila is the co-founder of the Green Tech Alliance, a community of companies, VCs, media and experts united in the commitment to create solutions in the fight against climate change. She has been selected as Obama Leader for Europe for 2022 by the Obama Foundation, which recognizes emerging leaders who have demonstrated a commitment to advancing the common good. Lyubomila, welcome to We All Make Mistakes.
Thank you so much for having me.
My first question is, how did you end up where you are right now?
I must say it was not the most conventional path because I actually studied business and I've been in the finance industry for the years before Plan A. I was in investment banking, VC, then fintech. And climate change found me in 2016 while I was on a trip to supposedly learn how to surf. Did not happen. On the first day of this trip, I ended up cleaning a beach from plastic, which was quite shocking in terms of the quantity that was available on this most famous beach with the biggest waves that you can find next to Agadir. And it was not necessarily this movie moment where I dropped everything and decided to settle in Morocco to educate myself on climate change. But essentially, I went back to London and became a bit obsessed with the topic of climate change, decided to learn the scientific side of it because clearly there was a lot of facts, but they were not necessarily well embedded in the way we were talking about the issue. And after 1 year and a few experiments, I decided that there was nothing else I could be spending my time on but actually building a business to address the issue.
You studied at the London School of Economics, so you could have been a typical LSE profile, just, you know, becoming an investment banker and then rising the ranks and so on. So was there a struggle there? Did at any point did you feel that maybe you were making a mistake?
It was really challenging to go through the process of deciding that I really wanted to spend my time on this purpose-driven business building and within this year of educating myself about the issues. But what really triggered me to feel confident and comfortable to kick off the building of Plan A was actually the overwhelming amount of information and data that I gathered within the 12 months of educating myself that was constantly confirming to me that there was not enough action that was taken. And there was not enough analysis that was showcasing how much money businesses were going to lose if they were not acting on climate change. It felt like society was in front of this existential issue that was not being tackled, even though, we had all the data for that.
And I know from having read some of the interviews you previously did that everything you do is data driven. Do you remember having a striking data point, a striking fact that told you, this is my calling, this is what I need to do?
Absolutely. And this was part of the first experiment I conducted in 2016 when I was still understanding the depths of the issue. So what I built was a data model that was looking into, on one hand, the worst environmental indicators, where and why certain geographies were being already impacted by climate change. And then on the other hand, I compared this to the amounts of money that were going into addressing these issues. The result was devastating. There was no positive correlation between the two sides of the story, which was just to explain how little we were using the facts and the data that we had at hand, that were there with decades of research that was behind them to essentially define how we were tackling the issue.
Mm. Another tool that we use a lot in psychology to drive change is storytelling. And in terms of climate change, you know, I'm also thinking about big movies, maybe Don't Look Up, that have the power to kind of tell a narrative that is so powerful that people change. Do you see any role in storytelling in what you do with Plan A?
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the most powerful toolkits that you can have if you want to be an effective participant in this kind of joint effort to address climate change. Storytelling is, from my perspective, this play with the emotional side of the issue, but not in a manipulative way, more like really understanding that the human being is a species that is driven by emotions, driven by the emotional memory related to a particular place or a particular experience. And we still have this stigma thinking that climate change is this unclear blob of trauma that is going to unfold in our life cycle and essentially implement or influence a lot of significant changes. But we cannot navigate it because it's too big. Our lifetime is too short for us to act on it. So why even getting involved? And that's not the way we can address this issue. There's no need for desperation. The reality is there. It's a matter of making it part of reality. And I think storytelling has a big part to play.
Absolutely. And in my research on persuasion, what I tend to argue and review in my work is the need basically for a toolbox that has everything from a very science-driven and kind of fact-based rational arguments, but things that are much more emotional as well and more about storytelling. Different people react to different messages, and some messages that are, I would say, very rational will have an effect on some people, but not on others. So if we're thinking about climate change and changing people's behavior so that they become more environmental friendly, we need to have a toolbox and we need to use different approaches, because you're not addressing and you're not using the same message with someone that, let's say, is a climate change denier.
This is something that really requires, as exactly as you say, this customization of the storytelling so that we don't meddle with the facts, but we allow for people to understand how their reality is going to be impacted by climate change.
And since we're talking about changing people's behavior, I'm also interested in your own leadership styles and how you lead others and how you try and change the behavior of people within your team. I know that from what I've read about you, you're someone that like to lead, you know, by the example. So you restrict a lot of what you eat and what you buy to things that are not processed. But tell us a bit more about how your fight and all the things that you've managed to create with Plan A is reflected in your style of leadership.
My most important attribute as a leader is my sense of humor. And I'm not saying it to make a compliment to myself. It's more that I always think that people need to be in a positive mindset in order to be able to deliver the best results. So I lead by example, by being always this person that comes in the office, comes in a meeting, really with a big smile on their face, and always tries to find a connecting point with others and to make sure that they are in their best mood, in their best mental state. And I think this is incredibly important in the context of the topic that we deal with, because decarbonizing industries is not an easy job. It's a complex product that we're building. We have a lot of scientists, we have a lot of data engineers, and all of them are applying their skills to this particular topic. But it could get quite emotional, especially if you're looking into the other side of the story where climate change is unfolding on a daily basis. Other things that I do related to being the person that is always going to be rolling my sleeves up first and like really getting involved into the details, not in the sense of being part of every project in the company, that's not even possible, but really being there when the work needs to be done, to get it done, and to support with any skill, network, or just moment thought that I have, any projects that can benefit from my understanding. I'm not a data engineer, but I know how to connect the dots between the work of data engineers and sales. So that's another thing that I do. And finally, it has been about consistency and discipline. In terms of my day-to-day in the company, it really is about the discipline of showing up, always being there, and really delivering my best work on a daily basis. I meditate a lot, and that really helps me to keep my mind clear because my agenda is mad.
And you mentioned meditation. Is there anything you do to kind of keep negative thoughts away? How do you make it so that, or how do you avoid negative thoughts from getting you down?
In the beginning of Plan A, I was doing a lot of yoga, and this is something that has stayed with me, and it's really powerful to kind of balance body, mind, and soul. Meditation is something that has come more recently in my life, the last few months, and it has been a necessity because just my schedule, my lifestyle has significantly changed over the last 18 months, where I'm working like 12, 14 hours a day. I'm not selling my lifestyle to anyone. There's no glory in it. It's more a personal choice that I have made, and I've learned how to make sure that I don't exhaust myself with that kind of an agenda. And meditation really helps me on being at the top of my energy. I test myself in the morning before I even get into a meditative state to understand, did I sleep well? Sleeping is a really key component, I think, of everyone's life, but we underestimate how important it is to sleep well.
Now, I've got a lot of questions around the difficulties that you've encountered so far in your career. But if you could summarize, what were the main difficulties you encountered in your career so far?
Probably the first one that is a bit more meta philosophical was the actual conundrum that I needed to deal with when I was switching from finance to the topic of Plan A. I really had a bit of a struggle because, as you rightfully mentioned in the beginning, I have been trained as someone that should think of themselves as a management consultant, investment banker, a worker in a large corporate, but not necessarily an entrepreneur. I'm 32, so when I graduated, that was 2014, and essentially what was the trend then was that tech companies would be defined as Amazon and Google. So that was a really big struggle because I had a bit of an identity crisis. All of my friends were going into the McKinsey's, the BCG's of this planet. But I was always obsessed with tech. So this was something that was in the back of my mind since I was a child. I've always been analyzing the latest tech, getting to test gadgets from friends of mine or buying them and really being the person that is best informed about tech. So it really has been something that has always been in the back of my mind. So that was a first struggle of trying to fit myself into this vision that I had that had nothing to do with the reality that was defined for me. Other struggles were related to actually reskilling myself in the sense that I definitely understand how to do business. This is what I've been taught of doing and this is what I've been trained for. But I quite quickly learned that I needed to learn about science. And what this meant was that I really had to be engaged and informed and defined in my views about climate change by this scientific community. There was a different type of person. It was a different type of human being that would be sitting in front of me. And that was challenging, not because the conversations were unpleasant, more so because it was that at 24, 25, I essentially had to be in the situation of basically building a totally new version of myself. And that was not always easy. And then the final element that I could mention has definitely been the first few years of Plan A, where we were basically the only company that existed doing what we're doing now. And I say this with a lot of comfort, confidence, and also pride, because I think it was really great that we had this awareness at that point, because it paved the way for many other companies to feel confident to go on this journey. But it wasn't easy because I've heard no from investors like hundreds and thousands of times. And I've been told that I'm building an NGO. I've also been kind of told that there's never a case where a business model can be making money while you're doing something good for the planet, because this is for the tree huggers. And these stigmas are still somewhere hidden.
Mm-hmm. And on your way to the creation of Plan A, how did you find the courage to leave your job in finance? Often when I discuss with my students' career choices, I said, you know, I tell them the risk with starting as an investment banker or a management consultant is that you're going to be trapped. It's going to be the most beautiful, the best paid trap you can think of because you get rewarded. So at what point was there a kind of a breaking moment where you said, that's it, you know, I've got my calling and now I've got the guts to leave my career in finance?
Oh, definitely. And this was really, again, this nice mix between facts and my own conviction. I think building this data model was the first triggering point where I was like, this is insane. I cannot believe that there's so much data out there that has been gathered over decades and that shows actually how much money I needed, what are the issues, how by waiting for a few years, these issues are just going to deepen. And eventually, that was not something that we were spending time on. And then the second point was the second experiment that I conducted, which was an interview series with 300 people, predominantly from investment banking VC, essentially my network in London, where I asked them the basic question of, what do you know about climate change? Do you care about climate change? Do you think you have a responsibility for climate change? And the answers were just overwhelmingly misinformed and also delegating responsibility elsewhere. And it triggered me to think that these two experiments were just enough for me to know that there was a lot of misinformation, there was a lot of misguidance, and also, I would say, negligence when it did to climate change that needed to be addressed in one way or another.
Do you sometimes feel a bit powerless in your fight against climate change?
No. And the reason for this is that I think we just don't have time to feel powerless. Every single one of us is actually a powerhouse. I truly believe in the power of people. And that's why I'm super proud of the Plan A team, because we just have like rock stars, one from the other. Everyone is an expert in what they have studied, what they've decided to dedicate themselves to. And they've decided to put their efforts into addressing climate change. But I never feel powerless, because the only thing that could make me powerless is sitting down, looking at something that I feel like, wow, I just got yet another rejection from an investor. If I spend time on delegating my thoughts and designating my attention to this, I have lost 5 essential minutes on doing something that is productive. And also, I think no one's life has ever been easy. And we just need to take these chances as the opportunity to learn, to grow, but not to be devastated, because life is awesome. We just need to be happy and take the chance that we have to be an actor of change.
I want to come back on something you said, which is that from perhaps the investor and the general public's point of view, it might be at times difficult to explain that, yes, you can do something and run a company that is trying to improve how society works, do good things for the environment and for the future of our planet. Yet for it to be a for-profit, that is not an NGO or not for-profit, how do you reconcile the two yourself? And why do you think this is a mistake, a common mistake that people make in terms of judging the kind of, you know, for-profit, but also pro-environmental or pro-societal issues type of companies?
We need to remember where our economy started and how it has been built since then. At the moment, the KPI for success is GDP. It's the growth in GDP. It's about the revenues, about the profits. And essentially, when you look at this metric system, you probably, with very little knowledge on climate change or ESG, you understand that there's something missing in it, because we truly don't understand the costs of what it takes for this economy to be growing at a certain stake. And I think COVID has been, sadly, but also usefully, a good revelation of what are the challenges ahead of us if we really don't start paying the true cost for the products that we buy, the things that we eat, the things that we produce, and the waste that we create. If you look at the supply chain disruption that we saw, the increasing energy prices that we see now all over Europe, these are all repercussions for an unbalanced and badly structured system. And this is not to say that everything about our economy is bad, not at all. Like, we've achieved incredible progress and we should be incredibly proud. But added on top of that was the question of the model that we had chosen to do good for the planet. So it really was difficult to explain to many why there was an economic value in building a software like ours, and how this is really going to be an opportunity for businesses to really thrive and be the leaders of tomorrow. All of this was actually a collection of many different situations in which the core existence of the company was questioned. My way of thinking was questioned. The way we were taking steps to position ourselves was being questioned. And also the request for money was questioned. And I would put it as one single issue, because I think it's this mindset shift that needed to happen, combined with a deeper understanding of the economic benefit of being more sustainable.
Jeremy speaking, is there a mistake, for instance, you've made that you will never forget? And how did you learn, and how did you kind of, you know, went back from making that mistake to making sure you never do it again?
One of the big learnings from last year was being incredibly focused on my well-being, to get to be as supportive as possible for the well-being of the company. To bring it down to a more practical level, what I mean by this is that there was a few months last year that I was exhausted. I was just so overworked and I was constantly under the amount of hours that I would normally sleep. I was constantly like under pressure, and I took a step back. I basically just cleared out my agenda for a few days and took the time to really think through my day-to-day, through my priorities, my activities, and just really focus on what really brings me happiness. And now I'm just incredibly disciplined. I keep track of the amount of meditation that I do. I like listen to my mind when I'm tired. Like, I just switch off even if I'm halfway through a task, because I know that this can trigger like other negative impacts. And I'm just really strict with myself.
Do you think we should talk more about mental health in the workplace? Is that a mistake that we're doing, especially in the startup world, which can be ruthless, to be honest?
Mental health is the most important KPI for actual productivity or time management. I think if people are disengaged, if people are demotivated, that actually leads to them not being able to do their best work.
And from the research I do currently on Generation Z, younger generation, they seem to be even more willing to talk about it, but also seeing it as an imperative in the workplace. I'm going to finish with the fire questions that we call the Proust questionnaire, after the French writer Marcel Proust. What's a mistake you keep on making, but you hope one day you won't?
Watering my plants. I keep on killing plants, and I really hope I stop doing that.
If you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice at that moment, what would it be?
Take it slow. I think you just need to take the time to get things done. And the more times you do something, the better and faster you become at doing it. But take your time.
Is there a piece of advice that you've received and that you wish you had not followed?
Every single person on this planet and everyone that I've spoken to is always happy to give advices. And I think I always take people's advices with a pinch of salt, because they are calculated through the mindsets, thinking patterns and prism of someone else. So maybe are not necessarily applicable to me.
What mistakes are you the most forgiving about with others?
Spilling your coffee. I've seen so many people get so stressed out when someone spills a coffee on them. I think it's totally okay for us to be accepting of, you know, of these kinds of activities. It just happens.
Listening to Lubomila today, we learned about the importance of leading by example and incarnating the values that you're preaching with your behavior. We also learn about the importance of staying true to yourself and showing a good sense of humor, staying optimistic. And interestingly, Lubomila brought up a topic that is very important and increasingly important, especially for younger generation: the need to slow down, the need to find balance, to be mindful about your own mental health. And I think altogether, we had a spectacular example of a true-to-herself entrepreneur and someone that doesn't see it as a bad thing to deglamorize entrepreneurship and say that, yes, it's tough and it's not necessarily a lifestyle for everyone. Thanks for listening to We All Make Mistakes, the podcast that finds value in what everyone else is trying to avoid, getting it wrong, with me, Ben Voyer, a professor of entrepreneurship at ESCP Business School. Thanks to the team who worked with me on this, Emily, Lara, You Love Words, and the recording studio, Laria Boutique. If you enjoy this podcast, please hit subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you just can't get enough, check out Her Voice, a sister podcast from The Choice, which aims to contribute to women's visibility in their domains of expertise.